Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Lots of Christmas wish lists include tablets and laptops. PCs? Not so much. Personal computer sales are down, and some believe they're down for the count. Joining us now to talk about the decline of the PC is Mark Rogowski. He wrote an article for Forbes about the death of the PC. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Happy to be here.
You wrote that the third quarter of 2011 was the last best quarter for PC shipments. Why is the decline of the PC, well, for most of us, felt rapid? Maybe in the tech world, it's like, 5,000 years ago.
I think what's happened is that the reasons why people used to buy new computers seem to have disappeared. It used to be that every couple of years you'd get a faster computer that did a lot more than the previous one that justified buying a new one. That seems to have gone away. And in its place, people have gotten excited about buying things like tablets. And so the spending that used to occur on computers has been sort of shifted over to the tablet buying marketplace.
What about the laptop? What kind of impact has that had?
It's also falling. Already, you'd seen a shift away from desktop computing to laptops, starting about 5 or 7 years ago. And so most new computers, certainly in the developed world, are already laptops. But even there, if someone's got a three-year-old laptop, they probably find it's pretty satisfying, and they're probably not wishing for a new one this Christmas. Maybe when it's a five-year-old laptop, they'll buy a new one, but that sort of extension of the purchasing cycle makes it look more like a car than a technology product.
Can that sort of extension support development and the manufacturing of affordable PCs going forward?
Well, that's an interesting question. They certainly are affordable at the low end these days, but development of exciting new ones seems to be challenging. If you look at who makes computers at this point, very few people are making a lot of money doing it. HP is struggling. Dell is struggling. A lot of the market share has gone to Lenovo in China, but it's not clear they're making a lot of money selling those PCs.
My guest is Mark Rogowski. He's a technology contributor to Forbes magazine. If you have a question or comment for him, we're talking about the death of the PC. Do you agree or disagree? What do you think? You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So if there were new technologies that could really give a boost to the computing abilities of the PC, would that make a difference?
I think probably not. If new technologies came along that could help PCs, they'd also probably help tablets. And what we're seeing more and more is that people really love these things they could hold in their hand, put their fingers to the screen of, and carry with them all the time. And now that you have tablets that are down below 1 pound, like the new iPad Air or the Kindle HDX, people are just finding that they're able to take them with them sort of wherever they go. So if technology gets better and it filters down, it's going to be in the tablets too, which will make them even more capable, which will probably give people even less reason to buy a new PC.
Some people had been blaming and are blaming low PC sales on the economy. To what extent might the economy in 2011, boy, things were really hitting rock bottom after, well, not rock bottom, but kind of they were struggling after the 2008 rock bottom.
So I look at a lot of data and things like that, and when you see trends that sort of have occurred over the last 5 or 6 years, you're immediately suspicious that the recession had a big role. But PC sales actually recovered decently out of the 2008 recession and started to grow into 2011, where we seem to hit a record number. There is impact in the developing world, China, India, people buying computers who never bought them before, both for home and business use. And once that peak has been reached, we've been coming down pretty strongly off of it, which has never happened before. Car sales, they go up and down with the economy. PC sales had never come down. They've come down enough that it seems pretty far-fetched to believe that that peak's ever going to be reached again.
It seems like those tablets and the very small laptops and that sort of thing are going to be much more usable in the developing world going forward.
And it's not just that. In a lot of the developing world, your computer is your smartphone. We think of our computer as some big device with a keyboard and a hard drive. But if someone who's never had one before gets a smartphone and has never had any computer, and that's what gets them online, they think of that as a computer. It's not a term that makes sense to us necessarily, but it's the way they sort of connect with the world. So trying to show up to them and bring them a 5-pound laptop and say, this is better, they're not going to even understand why it might be in many cases.
That's interesting. Is that more the case in the developing world than it is in the United States? In other words, what are people, we know they're replacing it with smartphones, laptops, tablets. Is it pretty much all of the above everywhere, or are there different iterations of it?
It is, but the trends differ in different places. You know, in Japan, although they've always been high technology, they were never big adopters of desktop computers. It wasn't until small laptops came around that you could really fit computers into your lifestyle in Japan, where residences tend to be much smaller than we're used to in the U.S., for example. But the trends on tablets seem to be pretty much everywhere. As fast as they're growing in the U.S. with the popularity of the iPad and the Android tablet, for example, in a lot of the Far East, people are buying these much less expensive tablets to watch video and to occasionally connect to the internet. So they're becoming rapidly popular and will soon be sort of as ubiquitous as phones, which are sold by the couple billion at this point every year. So the trends are slightly different, but they all seem to be headed in mostly the same direction.
Seems like another market that might be hit hard then would be the television market.
I think the television market is next. I think, we talk about sort of like peak car, how we sold the most cars in this country that were, or have we driven the most miles or sold the most cars that we're going to sell. I think we've hit peak PC, and I think peak TV is next. I'll be going to a Consumer Electronics Show in January in Las Vegas, and I'm going to try and suss out to see how bad that situation is. But I suspect you're probably right about television.
So is it the home for personal use or in the workplaces where the PCs are declining more? Because I still see a lot of PCs around the office. Of course, we are public media.
Right. No, I think in the office, you're not likely to see PCs go away. The big change is, in the 90s when the PC became ubiquitous in the office, it was replaced almost every 3 years. Then the IT department stretched that out to 4 years because there was less reason to buy it all the time and it was expensive to replace it all the time. Now they're looking at sort of 5- and 6-year replacement cycles, sometimes even longer. So I think what you'll see is PCs in the workplace, at least for some workers, will probably be around 20 or 30 years from now. They just may be 6- or 7-year-old devices in much the same way that the desk you're working at hasn't been replaced very recently. If it breaks, you're going to call somebody in maintenance and they're going to bring you a new desk. But otherwise, you're probably not likely to get a new one very quickly.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering about people who do work on PCs that do it for they're the engineers or that they want the big screens and all the stuff that the PCs have. If 20 or 30 years from now, they're going to be working on a 7- or 8-year-old computer, you're saying at best, but I'm still wondering who's going to be out there to support them. I'm wondering about companies like Microsoft, HP, Dell. How are they going to stay afloat?
I guess we'll see. Some of these sort of niche markets, for instance, there'll always be engineers and designers, as you say, who need brand new high-end PCs. But
yeah.
Niche markets can be supported. There's people buy projectors for their home theaters. That's fewer than 100,000 people in the U.S. every year, and yet there's a robust infrastructure to support those people to install them, people to manufacture them, really high-end products. So I don't think we'll see the products disappear entirely, but I don't know that we'll see people making a lot of money selling them either. So you ask them a tough question, it's the right question about who's going to be left to sell them. Probably, some version of Apple will be around selling a few of them, and then one or two other major PC manufacturers will still survive, and they'll be in multiple businesses, including making some PCs for the people who need them. Whether that's HP or Dell is really hard to say. I don't know that either of them will still be in that business.
It's interesting to think of PCs as a niche market. I guess I'm just old,
Not at all.
Well, all right. So you think some of the companies will survive? You think they'll all survive in some fashion, or do you think some will go down?
I think they won't all survive in every fashion, but there used to be a couple hundred PC manufacturers, and now there's really, as a practical matter, probably around a dozen. I think that it's very likely that neither HP nor Dell will be a PC manufacturer down the road. HP considered spinning off the division when Meg Whitman became CEO. She reversed the decision temporarily, but I suspect that she'll revisit that down the road. And Dell now is going to be a private company for the foreseeable future and can make more difficult decisions like just waking up one morning and deciding to stop making PCs. you know, there'll be people who will then fill the gap in terms of the Lenovos and Acers of the world. And a company like Intel right now still gets almost all of its revenue making the chips for those computers. So they're not in a position to sort of stop making them or developing those chips anytime soon. So it's a slow transition. When we write these things for, you know, for online consumption, we sort of try and catch the news and say the death is coming. But the death's going to be slow. Whether it's painful or not, that's a different question.
As a former newspaper journalist, I have to ask, what about PC Magazine or PC World?
Well, you know,
what's going to happen to them?
PC Magazine stopped publishing its print edition several years ago.
I know.
Because it couldn't really justify the cost of the print edition. And I think that, you know, what's left of PC Magazine online is a very different publication, and a pretty good one, in fact. As with all these things, when they're interesting and exciting, there's a lot written about them. And when they're less interesting and exciting, there's less written about them. But again, look at the car industry, right? It sells about the same number of cars every year and has for quite a long time. But there are enthusiasts who love cars, and it supports sort of a robust industry talking about cars. Whether we'll see quite the same thing on computers is probably not the case, but I'm sure there'll be a vibrant technology press talking about whatever computing devices people are using for years to come.
We have an email from Matthew in Columbus. He writes, does your guest believe that desktop sales will gravitate more toward the domain of the do-it-yourself hobbyist gamer market than the general public going forward? He says, I personally use my smartphone for just about everything, but I still upgrade or replace my desktop every so often for its processing power with gaming and as use as a media center with Netflix.
Right. So he's a classic example of the people who need the processing power if he's a gamer, right? That's a niche market, but it's a pretty big niche of millions of people who love to play sort of high-end PC games and will do things like replace their graphics card or rebuild their whole computer every couple of years. So those people, they're not going away. And as long as there's game companies producing great new games, there'll be a market there. You know, it's just relatively speaking, probably about 1% of the total PC market in the world, as opposed to, say, 25% of it.
Okay, I'm going to put David on the phone now from San Francisco. We're just about out of time. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, how are you? You know, I wanted to ask about the stability of the markets in computers. In leading it up to, say, for example, the libraries and schools have been induced into buying PCs for all of their kids. And so they did that on a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. What are the brands that are likely to be here in 10 years so the school districts don't get cheated?
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
The future is always hazy. I mean, I'd be very surprised if Apple's not around in 10 years. They have so much cash, and they seem to be, and they're highly profitable. So people get frustrated with what they don't do, but they seem to be focused very much on keeping the business strong. I'd be very surprised if HP and Dell are not around in 10 years, but I would be very surprised if they make PCs in 10 years, and that might create support problems for schools. It's really hard to say. So it's a challenging question, and I don't know that there's an easy answer to that one.
Well, maybe when you know it, we'll have you on again, or maybe the sooner on another topic. Mark Rogowski, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Rogowski is a technology contributor to Forbes magazine. Coming up, we're going to talk about more Tech Tuesday topics. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The internet and social networks now spread information faster than ever, but it's not always reliable information. Remember that picture from the Superstorm Sandy? How could we forget? Take the revelation that Notre Dame linebacker Manti Te'o's online girlfriend didn't exist. Or what about the periodic Twitter hashtags claiming a celebrity has died? 2013 has been a year of notable cyber hoaxes. Some have dubbed it the year of the online hoax. Joining us now to recap some of the best fodder for that moniker is Doug Gross. Doug covers consumer technology, social media, and the web for CNN.com, and he's on the phone from Atlanta. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and thanks so much for having the conversation.
So how has 2013, is it the numbers of hoaxes, the impact of certain hoaxes? What makes it the year of the hoaxes?
Well, it really feels like it, doesn't it? It seems like the frequency and the way that these things can go so viral so quickly just has really ramped it up. It seems like every week there's some new story that's too good to be true. And, yeah, in many cases, they are literally too good to be true. You've got what you've got going on out there in large part is that's different than, I mean, throughout the entire history of the web, there's been bad information floating around, and social media certainly ramped that up. But what you've started to see is a real industry that thrives on pushing these very viral, very buzzy stories out as quickly as they can. And obviously, in many cases, you have folks who would, pay a little bit more attention to being first than they do to being right, unfortunately.
How much of it is just people playing hoaxes? They're not just sloppy, they're just hoaxing me.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you've got that system that sort of set itself up, and people are savvy. You know, folks figure out how they can manipulate the system. In recent times, you had the Jimmy Kimmel Show with this. I'm not sure if people have said the word twerking on your show very often, but this fake video of a woman dancing, and she flips over and catches her clothing on fire, went absolutely viral all over the place. A week later, you know, he comes on with this woman who turns out to be a stunt woman that they completely put up to it. So a lot of times it is just somebody kind of, thumbing their nose at the system a little bit, trying to see, just how viral can I make this complete phony story? And unfortunately, for good information, it seems to work more often than it doesn't.
It does make me wonder what these people used to do before there was the internet.
Exactly right. Just prank phone calls.
Yeah. Right. Hello, Mr. Presley. Is Elvis
right,
home?
Refrigerator running.
Right. How have they evolved over the years? You know, from the emails from the Nigerian princes, which I don't really consider hoaxes.
Right. Well, that's
those
a scam,
are scams.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a difference between scams and hoaxes, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's all a matter of intent, right? Like sometimes, yeah. But so yeah, you said from the beginning of the web, and certainly even before the web, that, you know, what's been dubbed the Nigerian scam goes back to actual snail mail letters and telephone calls in the past. So the desire, the intent is not new. It used to be, you know, your aunt who would send you the bad email about, you know, something Congress is voting on that turns out to be completely fictional. And thank God mm-hmm. for Snopes.com and people like that who have been around to sort of debunk those phony things that sometimes are spread maliciously, sometimes are spread accidentally. The end result has always been the same, which is spreading that information, that bad information. But the difference I think you have now is that you have certain websites, certain blogs who are built specifically to publish and spread this viral content. They take a piece of information that they think people are really going to go crazy for, and they do everything they can to get you, A, to click on it, and B, to share it on your Facebook page, on your Twitter account. They clicks equal money, and they want it clicked as many times as they can. So you have this sort of ancient instinct to either play jokes or try to get over with a scam, and now there are the mechanisms in place just to make it go really far, really fast.
Which explains how online hoaxes are becoming big business.
Yeah, absolutely, because unfortunately, and without citing any particular outlets, there's a desire to get it out there so quickly that they almost don't care. It's like, because let's say, okay, we put it out there, we get our clicks for the original story, then it turns out to be fake, great, we get to write another story. In the meantime, we'll put up blog posts, with people responding to it and people giving their opinions on it. So it's in a insidious sort of way, it's almost more valuable if credibility is not, something that you hang your hat on. It's almost more valuable to have the story expand itself out and eventually end up being fake, because then that's something else we'll click on to read, right?
How many operations are out there available to help people, sift through the I don't know, detritus out there.
Right. Well, obviously, I mentioned Snopes.com. Right. They've been around, and you know, love them. That site doesn't look any different than it looked in the late 1990s.
Right.
But for a tiny, you know, for a tiny little operation, they do such a good job. More times than not, they really focus in that, like, the phony email and the phony Facebook post going around, things like that. So that's just a standby. If it looks phony, go to Snopes first. They do such a great job. And what you will see sometimes too now emerging as these viral things become news, in a way, you will have outlets like CNN.com, like other folks, who want to report on them, want to do, you know, a light feature story on this, you know, viral content that's going around. But what you hope for is that's that second layer where, okay, we want to get this out there, but we're not going to do it unless we've reported it. I had a great story last year. I don't know if you ran into it or not, where there was a guy who was spreading the story that Abraham Lincoln invented Facebook, that he had found a patent. Abraham Lincoln had an idea for this newspaper. Right, of course. You know, if he had invented Facebook, he would have invented Facebook. But it was a newspaper, and every person would have their own page, and they would share things they like. And it was such a great story, and everybody went with it. So I was like, we have to write about this. So I called him, and I asked him if this is real. He said, no, absolutely not. Thank you for asking. it was a hoax. It was P.T. Barnum was mentioned in the story, which he gave all these clues that just sort of begged you not to believe him. But he said, you were one of the first people who actually called me and asked if this is true. No, it's not. So hopefully folks like us provide that second layer where obviously it's not going to be as quick as the folks who just push it out immediately, but hopefully somebody will come along and tell you whether a woman really did catch on fire by dancing on her apartment wall. She didn't.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and I'm talking with Doug Gross. He's a reporter on technology, social media, and the web for CNN.com. And we're talking about 2013. It's been dubbed the year of the hoax, or the online hoax, I should say. If there's a great hoax out there that you want to share with us, if you perpetrated a hoax or if you were duped by a hoax, give us a call and tell us about it. 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. But don't wait. We only have about 10 minutes to go. So how do sites like Snopes verify information? How do they – what do we know about how they operate?
Well, it's really, you know, similar to what we do. It's old fashioned shoe leather and old fashioned boring reporting. Pick up the phone, look for original news reports, things like this. A lot of these stories, but you know, sometimes it's as simple as a Google image search. If you've got a person purporting to be something or someone, the wonders of technology let us slap that photograph right in a Google image search and see where it shows up. I think I've seen the same giant snake about 10 times, and that snake has lived in about 10 different places every single time. But that was one where I was like, is this real? Google image search? Oh, there he is in South Africa and Florida and Alabama. So it's a very, very well-traveled snake as well.
I still want to believe there's a cloud like that over New York.
Exactly right. It just
it was so awesome.
Well, and that is the beautiful thing about these things, right? They play on things that we want to believe are true or things that we want to get outraged about. So, you know, in the case of, you know, the granny who defends herself from the knockout game, which may or may not be a hoax in and of itself, but there's something in us that wants to believe that this little old lady surprised these bad guys and pulled out her gun and scared them away. You know, it's just too good to stop and check and see if it actually happened.
It does make me wonder about so many things, like the video where the guy was walking in front of the car and he kind of kicked the car when it lurched forward, and the lady got out and started beating him with an umbrella.
Right.
You remember that one?
I
don't know. Was it real? I mean, it makes me start doubting everything.
I will not render a definitive verdict on that one because I don't recall, but in my heart, I seem to believe that one was fake. There was a housing inequality protest in San Francisco. I'm not sure if you saw this, but this guy who was purportedly a Google employee got out and just berated these folks and told them how, you know, you should make more money, and just all of these things that folks like me who pay attention to Google know that their employees tend to be rather tight-lipped. But it spread all over the place, and then sure enough, this guy was, you know, in with the protesters. It was all over. They called it street theater. So the fine line between street theater and lying, I guess, is one that can be debated.
How would you recommend people spot online hoaxes so they don't fall for them? Do you think you should always be skeptical nowadays? If it seems too warm-hearted, too sweet, too funny, too anything?
I think that's where we are, right? I mean, there's sort of a joke comment that goes around that just says, you know, rule number one of the internet, everything's fake. So it's like you almost are better off. If you are interested in real information, you're almost better off just if you see it online, assume it's fake or consider the source. I would like to think if CNN.com does something, if a known entity does something, I would like to think folks will put a little more faith, a little more trust that some work has gone into it. But if you don't recognize the source, especially if it's one of these sources that you know just sort of cranks out this viral content really quickly, before you hit share on Facebook, maybe give it a couple minutes to see if you can verify it or not.
What are some of your favorite hoaxes for 2013?
Oh, wow. The Thanksgiving Day airplane squabble. This is a guy named Elon Gale, who is a producer for a reality television show, which you can provide your own commentary on a producer for a reality television show making something up. But he began tweeting this, and again, we love when a bad guy gets their comeuppance, right?
Uh-huh.
There was this woman who was being horrible to the flight attendants and being very rude and telling them, you know, she needs to get home and see her family. It's Thanksgiving, and you know, this isn't about you. It's just, you know, being the bad guy, being the heel. And so he, according to his tweets, began sending her these little nasty grams written on cocktail napkins, and he sent her a glass of wine to get her to chill out, and then she said more horrible things to him, and it went back and forth. It was my social networks lit up with that story. People loved it. You know, several days later, he fessed up that he made the whole thing up, but not before on certain blogs there were people who came forward and said, "Well, I'm Diane's cousin, and she's sick, and you're a horrible person." So his hoax prompted other mini hoaxes, and it just sort of spread all over the place. Eventually on Twitter, he fessed up by saying that he was going to share a photograph of Diane in 7A, and the photograph was of an empty chair.
Do you consider it a hoax, the recent kerfuffle over the waitress who claimed that somebody didn't leave her a tip because they said she was gay, or maybe she was gay and didn't approve of her lifestyle and all that? Now it's all kind of blown up.
Right. Well, there's a thin line between hoax and scam, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And that would speak to intent, which, yeah, I can't read her mind, so I don't mm-hmm. know what the intent was. But certainly what happened, she shared this story of a family who had about $100 bill in her $100 tab in her restaurant. Then when they went to pay, they paid. They gave her no tip, and they wrote, we don't agree with your lifestyle. Whether it was her intent or not, the internet sort of rallied around her. People donated, I believe it was upward of $2,000 to make up for this horrible thing. And then it certainly looks like that was not true. If it's a commentary, the restaurant suspended her and has got her out of there now. So
mm-hmm.
it speaks to intent. If it's a hoax, just, you know, the old P.T. Barnum bit, you know, sucker born every minute,
mm-hmm.
Which he may or may not have actually said. That's one thing. If you're trying to sort of, you know, tweak the nose of folks or just have a good laugh, that's one thing. When you spread this information, you know, maliciously to sort of scam people out of money, that raises a whole new set of questions.
I'm just dying to talk to Gary from Columbus. I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know. Gary, are you a hoax?
I don't know if I'm a hoax or not.
Okay.
it's hard to tell sometimes.
What's your question, Gary?
I really like the idea of human-powered flight. So I was just roaming a little bit on the internet and anything having, you know, any remote idea with that. And I came across this YouTube thing, video, that supposedly is just wild, I guess, but It shows a guy strapping on a pair of, looked like ultralight wings. Got some kind of arm movement type gizmo or whatever. And then it shows him running down this big open field and flapping his wings and taking off.
That's right. And wouldn't it be nice to think that that's really happening?
I want my jetpack.
Something like that definitely preys on our, I wish that were true.
Those of us of the Jetson generation.
Exactly.
It was like so believable almost, but, it was obvious.
These folks are really good. I mentioned the Jimmy Kimmel video. Mm-hmm. He had a professional stunt woman come in and really, pretend to be dancing and flip over and land on her candle and start a fire. So there are people who put an enormous amount of work into getting these things to go viral, and it's hard to tell sometimes.
If you can manipulate a photograph, you can manipulate film as well.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Or you can. You talk about the photographs, the forced perspective, again, going back to my, giant snake or giant hog or giant alligator, there are photographic tricks where you can, make something appear to be, much bigger than it actually is. And, as you noted, you can, do similar things with video. I still want to think Sasquatch is real. I think maybe that Bigfoot video, that was the precursor to all of this, right?
We just don't know.
That's right. I will reserve justice. I will reserve judgment on Bigfoot.
And Gary, I'm going to reserve judgment on the flying guy, too, because, I'm still hoping for that jet pack. Thanks, Gary, for the call. Doug Gross from CNN.com, thanks a lot for your talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Really enjoyed it.
Doug Gross, he's a reporter on technology, social media, and the web for CNN.com. Coming up, we're going to get gift ideas for the little tots in your life from Russell Holly from Geek.com. So stay with us on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's prime time for holiday shopping, and parents are searching for that perfect gift for their children. And the realm of tech is a good place to start these days. Joining us now to discuss what's new, what's good, and what is just plain weird in the world of gadgets for kids is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com, and the parent of how many children now, Russell?
Three.
Three. Three kids. So he knows what he's talking about. Welcome to the show, Russell.
Thank you for having me back.
All right. So let's just get the training toilet with the iPad out of the way. What are we talking about here?
I was wondering if you were going to start with that.
Well, these kind of things just tick me off, because if I'd had one of these things when my kid was little, blah, blah, blah. But what does it do?
So it's a piece of plastic. And I saw this last January, actually. It was at CES. And for some reason, it took them a really long time to actually get this to market. It only just came out recently. It is called the iPotty, and as the name would suggest, it is a plastic porta potty for kids. A training potty. Mm-hmm. That has an arm designed to hold an iPad, a full size 10-inch iPad.
Why?
I know.
While they just sit there and contemplate.
Answer why?
You mean instead of sitting there contemplating their navel, they can contemplate their favorite cartoon while they wait.
Right. Yeah, the idea is that they'd have access to, the apps that are on the iPad and videos that are on the iPad. So, if you have a child who, struggles to stay on the potty without getting bored and wandering off, without anything covering their bottom, then, if you are a parent who has had a wandering child in that particular age state, then that can lead to disaster. But I can't justify, it just seems really, really hard for me to give what would effectively be a one-year-old my tablet while sitting on the potty. That's hard for me to justify personally. But it is there. It is $40, and Toys R Us now carries it. If you are brave, or just have a lot of iPads laying around.
one for every room.
Then you can give this a shot.
It kind of sounds more like a gift for an adult, though, meaning that it makes an adult's
more like
life. That too, but it seems like it makes the adult's life better. The kid, you know, they're getting a toilet.
Yeah. I don't think we have enough time to discuss distracted parenting.
Okay, All right, moving on to some more standard gifts. One of the consoles that is a recent release is the Nintendo 2DS. What are the important features of this device? Does it offer anything new over previous models?
Well, in a weird way, it intentionally takes stuff away. The Nintendo 2DS we talked about not too long ago as being the successor to the Nintendo 3DS, in that it doesn't fold in half. It doesn't have the 3D screen. It only comes in the two colors. It's kind of this bulky-ish plastic wedge. But those are all the things that I think make it a much better purchase for smaller children, you know, younger children, than the actual 3DS or the 3DS XL, which are both very similar devices that Nintendo has released in the past. This is cheaper than any of the other Nintendo DS consoles. It's $129. So a lot of stores are selling it with a game for $150. And it requires a whole lot less in the way of setting it up before you hand it to your child, depending on, how you did that. You know, for me, when I got a 3DS for my son, I had to go in and turn off the 3D mode and, you know, set up parental controls and you know, disable a lot of the features that I didn't necessarily want my son to have access to. And a lot of that is already pre-set up with this. It's actually really nice.
So it's childproofed in advance.
It is significantly more childproof. Nintendo's always done a pretty good job making sure that the DS consoles and the Wii have been not quite as breakable as some of the other electronics in your house. But this is pretty clearly the result of a lot of research in what happens when a DS hits the ground or when it gets sat on or something like that. This design seems to take care of a lot of those concerns, in my opinion, and a lot of stuff that it seems like they learned from building the controller for the Wii U was implemented in this as well. So I would definitely say that it's sturdier than the 3DS or the 3DS XL in those aspects.
Okay. And all right. So all that said, to what age level would it be appropriate then? From what to what?
I think that this would be fine for, ages 4 to 10. If it's going to be, their first, video game system, I think if you get above age 10, it ends up being a little awkward to hold. The size of the hand starts to change, and so the XL console may be more appropriate for that age bracket. But I think that for younger kids, which has been Nintendo's audience for a really long time, that this is definitely the version of the DS console that I would purchase. And I did purchase for one of my kids.
Disney Infinity is a game that includes lots of characters from Disney Pixar movies. What does the game offer as far as gameplay that makes it attractive to kids, in your opinion?
So Disney kind of took a page from the Skylanders franchise, which we've talked about in the past, where you've got these little figurines that you set on a platform, and it actually moves those players, it actually moves those characters from the physical platform to the actual game, and allows you to run around and play them. This takes that and incorporates pretty much every, major Disney character that has been seen in the last 10 years,
wow.
Which, is a powerful thing for Disney because they've got quite a few of those. So they've got heroes setups and villain setups from, Cars, Monsters, Inc., The Incredibles, just a ton of different Disney properties that have these individual figurines that you can purchase the individual figurines or you can purchase them in sets. And when the kid goes to play it, you can play on the you can play on PlayStation, you can play on Wii, you can play on Xbox, you can play on the Nintendo 2DS or 3DS. And what happens is you get these platforms that get set up, they get plugged in, and then you take the physical character, this little toy model, and you set it on the platform, and it puts that character in the game for you to play.
Is the need for action figures just a way to make more money, or does it enhance the gaming experience? How does that work?
So this is, you know, kind of the next age of the way I've looked at it. It's really kind of the next step towards the trading games. You know, when I was younger, my brothers were really into Pokemon cards,
right,
and those kind of things. And what was important about those, you know, wasn't so much that, you know, you had to buy all the different cards, but that you could take them to friends and trade and, you know, improve based on those experiences. You get the same thing out of Disney Infinity, where you can buy kits and take the ones that, you know, you don't want and you can trade, and then also play in the game. And you can play with your friends as well. So it adds that, you know, it kind of adds that social component to it. It is definitely an expensive habit to start.
Oh,
By no means is it an inexpensive habit to start. Actually, between the Skylanders franchise and the Disney Infinity franchise, Disney's characters are significantly more expensive per model. They're $2 more expensive per model.
Uh-huh.
Their kits end up being a little bit more expensive. The starter kits are the same price for both Skylanders and Disney Infinity. But if you are going to choose one or the other, understand that Disney is absolutely charging more for theirs.
If my guest is Russell Holly, of course, tech blogger for geek.com, we're talking about gifts for kids, tech gifts for kids. If you have a question or comment for him on that score, 614-292-8513. If you have another tech question for Russell, you know, we always try to take those too. So you can hang on. We'll squeeze those in at the end. But if you have a gift question for kids, 614-292-8513 is the number to call. Are games like Disney Infinity and Skylander Swap Force designed so that players try to beat the game by accomplishing certain tasks, or more focused on general gameplay? How does that?
Well, so Skylanders is set up so that you have an end goal. You know, you're going to take on the bad guy at the end, and so you build up your characters so that you can get to the end and do that. And the way that Skylanders make sure that you're purchasing, you know, more models is that there are certain areas of the game that are only available if you have the correct element of character. So you have to make sure that you have, different figurines from each one of the elements. But Disney Infinity is more of an open world kind of exploration with game, setups involved. You know, so you can actually explore the world of Captain Jack Sparrow, or you can, you know, wander through the world of The Incredibles, and you can play different missions within those worlds to make things, you know, kind of more interesting and to keep the kids focused on the stories that they're already, you know, already attached to.
Right. Well, let's move on, because I'm intrigued by this Globe Ice Lantern kit.
I have been doing this for a week now, and what? I can't stop making them. I'm absolutely fascinated.
What are they?
So this was an ice lantern kit that I found on ThinkGeek.com. I haven't been able to find it anywhere else. It's very simple.
I'm sorry, you found it on Think what?
ThinkGeek.
Think, of course, ThinkGeek.
Yeah, I mean, where else would I shop, really?
Yeah, right.
A kid safe project. They're $15 on their website, and it gives you a series of these gigantic balloons and clips and stands, and it is a balloon that you basically fill with water and then put on this stand. The stand creates kind of a thermal layer so that the bottom part doesn't freeze. Then you take the entire thing and you put it either in your freezer, or if it's cold like it is here, you stick it outside, and the outer layer of the bubble of the balloon that you've created starts to freeze, but it's still hollow in the middle. There's still water in the middle.
Huh.
And then you cut the balloon off of this round ice cube that you've created, basically this round block of ice. And the center is still hollow. The water, you know, comes out, and you've got this hollow ice globe that you can then put lights in and set out on your front porch, and it just looks really cool.
Yeah, they are really, really cool. They look beautiful. And you said you could just keep making them. You make six globe lace lanterns with one kit.
The one kit gets you the six balloons, but really once you figure out where you can get the balloons, which is pretty much any craft store, it's the same balloons that you get, you know, as party favors, where you have the rubber bands attached to them and you punch them and they bounce back and forth. You can get them at any party store. It's really, you know, what you're paying for is the insulator and the stand so that they look nice, so that they sit nice when you put them, you know, outside instead of rolling around or falling over.
Yeah.
Design is initially set up for tea light candles that you can put on the inside, but those same, you know, party stores or craft stores will also have those fake candle LEDs that you can stick in, and you know they obviously last a whole lot longer.
These are super cool, and tell us again where you found them.
I found them at ThinkGeek.com. They are called Globe Ice Lantern Kits.
They are very, very pretty. Judith and Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly from Geek.com. Welcome.
Hello. This is Judith.
Yep.
Yes, I have a 9-year-old grandson who wants to be a movie maker, but we really don't know what kind of video equipment at the low end in terms of cost to get for him so that he can start that process, learning to make movies for himself.
So Toys R Us, I think, is the only one that sells them, but there is a movie maker kit made by Lego.
Oh.
And the camera itself looks like it's made of Legos. It has a whole bunch of Legos around it, but it's a camera and includes, you know, very basic software for your computer for making movies. I haven't seen them in a little while, but if memory serves, they're $65, and that's probably the best place to start.
Okay,
if I were to guess.
Thank you.
All right, Judith, thanks for the call. Boy, I want one of those globe ice lantern kits.
We got them the weekend. I made three of them so far.
Wait a minute. These are gifts for kids? Oh, that's right. Or the kid and you. No, the kid helped. Okay. What else do we have here today?
This was what I had as far as the gifts go.
Okay.
But I definitely wanted to talk a little bit as well about some of the stuff that was going on. We had a phone that I started messing with recently, and I wasn't sure that we were going to have time. It's called the Moto G.
Okay.
It's made by Motorola. This is, you know, I talk a lot about phones that are kind of the top of the line, you know, the best phone that's out there. These are phones that are made by Motorola that are specifically meant to be low-cost phones.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy it straight off the Motorola website, it's $169 for the full price of the phone, and understand that most phones that you get in stores are much closer to $600 if you buy them out of contract.
Right.
So this was a really fantastic phone that Motorola did. It had a very nice camera on the back. It felt really good. It had replaceable color backs that I thought was a really cool touch. And for, you know, $160, $170, it was a really amazing phone.
Okay. All right. We do have a caller who has a tech question for you. Let's check out that. Paul and Bexley are on the air with Russell Holly. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Hey, I'm going to get those ice gloves for my granddaughter, I think. That sounds really cool.
They look cool.
I was interested in a NAS network storage device, Russell. And I know a lot of them seem to be pretty expensive, you know, several hundred dollars. And then I saw this Western Digital MyCloud, which has like 2, 3, and 4 terabyte sizes. And I know they say they're not quite as fast as some of the others, but what do you know about them?
What do you think, Russell? Thanks, Paul.
So the My Worlds are definitely cool. The software is kind of limited. You have to follow Western Digital's rules, which can occasionally cause problems if you want to do something like streaming video. But as far as just, you know, raw data storage, they work really well.
All right. Paul, thank you so much for your call. Russell Holly, what do we cut coming up next week? Is it for teens?
I guess we should probably do adults next week.
Oh, adults next week. Okay. All right. Or the children and all of us. Thanks so much, Russell, for the ideas for today.
Thanks for having me.
It's Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.